Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine for a moment witnessing someone you know, or maybe even a stranger, suddenly collapse, lose consciousness. Your heart pounds, right? Just a faint. Or maybe something far more serious, like a seizure. That immediate gut-wrenching concern is universal, but the underlying causes, and therefore, your response, can be vastly critically different.
Indeed. And what's truly crucial here, I think, is recognizing that while both seizures and syncope, which is the medical term for fainting, can look similar, that sudden loss of consciousness, their origins are really distinct. One is an electrical event happening in the brain. The other is a temporary interruption of blood flow. And understanding that fundamental difference, well, it changes everything about how we approach these emergencies.
Absolutely. Today, we're taking a deep dive into your sources, particularly some excerpts from Pre-Hospital Emergency Care, Chapter 19, focusing specifically on seizures and syncope. Our mission, really, is to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, helping you quickly get well-informed on these critical events, how to tell them apart, and what immediate care principles are essential. We'll explore everything from the fundamental definition of a seizure to its many varied types, the crucial distinctions that separate it from a simple faint, and what steps to take when every second truly counts. So let's start with the absolute basics. Our sources define a seizure as a sudden and temporary alteration in brain function caused by electrical discharges in the brain. You can kind of picture it like a sudden chaotic electrical storm disrupting the normal communication pathways in the brain.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, actually, because while the underlying cause is electrical, what we see is a dramatic change in mental activity and behavior. Yeah. Now, when most people think of seizures, they immediately think of epilepsy. And sure, epilepsy is a common cause of seizures, but it's really critical to understand that seizures can also result from injuries or medical conditions. This is a profoundly important distinction because, well, it means not every seizure automatically points to a diagnosis of epilepsy. In many cases, it's actually a symptom of an underlying, often treatable issue.
That's a key insight right there. So the sources categorize seizures into two main types based on their origin, primary and secondary. Primary or unprovoked seizures are those that occur from a genetic or unknown cause. These can be generalized seizures, which involve both hemispheres of the brain affecting a widespread area, or partial seizures, which are more localized, involving just one hemisphere. Then we have secondary or provoked seizures. And these are particularly important because they happen from an underlying cause that can often be identified and crucially treated. The sources note these are usually generalized, affecting both sides of the brain, and the list of potential triggers is extensive. It really highlights the complexity in both diagnosis and immediate care.
Indeed. And what makes these secondary seizures so compelling and often challenging in the field is the sheer breadth of underlying causes, like it says in Table 19:1 from your materials. The real takeaway here isn't just the sheer number of potential triggers, but the crucial implication for emergency care. Seizures are often a symptom of an underlying treatable condition, not always a standalone neurological event. This shifts our immediate focus from just managing the seizure to, aggressively investigating and addressing its root cause. Think about common triggers like high fever, which is particularly common in kids, or for someone like Dan in our case study, non-compliance with seizure control medication he was prescribed. But the list goes much further. It includes serious stuff like infections, various types of poisoning, and critical metabolic imbalances like hypoglycemia, that's low blood sugar, or hyperglycemia, high blood sugar. We also see traumatic brain injury, which can trigger seizures right away or sometimes much later, plus states of shock, hypoxia, a dangerous lack of oxygen, stroke, or even drug or alcohol withdrawal. Cardiovascular issues like dysrhythmias, those irregular heartbeats, and hypertension, high blood pressure are also on the list, as are pregnancy complications like eclampsia. Even an electrolyte imbalance involving crucial elements like sodium and calcium can be a trigger, along with hyperthermia or extreme body temperature. And sometimes, even after all that, the cause remains idiopathic, meaning unknown. So this broad spectrum means identifying that specific trigger is absolutely vital for proper treatment and future prevention.
Okay, so with that fundamental understanding of what a seizure is, that electrical storm in the brain, the next crucial step in our deep dive is understanding how incredibly varied this storm could appear. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all event. They present in so many different ways, depending on which parts of the brain are affected by that electrical surge. Our sources helpfully break them down into two main categories: generalized and partial seizures. Let's dive into generalized seizures first. These are the ones that involve both hemispheres of the brain and the reticular activating system, which is basically the brain's master switch for alertness. This means the patient is not awake or aware during the event itself. The most recognized type, and often what people picture, is the tonic-clonic seizure, sometimes called a grand mal seizure. It has several distinct stages. It might start with an aura, which is a unique warning sensation. It could be a smell, a weird visual thing, or a sudden feeling of dread. This is followed by an immediate loss of consciousness, then the tonic phase, where muscles become rigid, the body stiffens. Next comes the hypertonic phase, where that rigidity becomes extreme, often with arching of the back, and finally the clonic phase, which is characterized by rhythmic jerking or convulsions, much like what Dan experienced in the case study. After the seizure, the patient enters what's called a postictal state, which is that period of confusion, drowsiness, and often just pure exhaustion as the brain recovers. Beyond the tonic-clonic, our sources also mention other generalized seizures. These include absent seizures, which are brief staring spells, might just look like daydreaming, myoclonic seizures, sudden brief muscle jerks, tonic seizures, characterized by sudden stiffening of muscles without the clonic phase, atonic seizures, where there's a sudden loss of muscle tone, causing a collapse, sometimes called drop attacks, and febrile seizures, which are specifically caused by high fever, most commonly seen in children. Moving on to partial seizures, also known as focal onset seizures, these involve one hemisphere of the brain, meaning the abnormal electrical activity is more localized. Within this category, we have some important distinctions. A simple partial seizure, or focal onset aware seizure, is key because despite the seizure activity, the patient is awake and aware. They experience abnormal movements of one area of the body, or maybe sensory changes, autonomic stuff, or even psychic sensations. Our materials note these may spread and generalize to become a more widespread seizure. Urgency medical care is typically needed if it's a first-time seizure, definitely, even if it seems minor, just to figure out the cause. Then there's the complex partial seizure, or focal onset impaired awareness seizure. Here, the patient remains awake, but is not aware of their surroundings or what's happening. These usually last 30 seconds to 2 minutes and might start with a blank stare, followed by random repetitive movements like lip smacking, picking at clothes, maybe repeating words or phrases. They won't respond to commands during it. And finally, a secondarily generalized seizure is when a partial seizure starting in one area then involves the entire body, progressing to those typical phases of a generalized tonic-clonic seizure we just talked about.
And this brings up another important point, something responders really need to be aware of. Psychogenic seizures. These are different. Unlike epileptic seizures, they aren't characterized by that chaotic electrical activity in the brain. Recognizing this physiological difference is key. It completely changes the assessment and the medical approach, moving away from traditional anti-seizure treatments. Your sources describe psychogenic seizures, also called psychogenic non-epileptiform seizures. What's critical here is that there's no change in the brain physiology during these seizures. These often last longer than a true generalized tonic-clonic seizure, which is a notable difference. And they can have distinct presentations, things like forward-thrusting pelvic movements and the head being turned from one side to the other. Understanding these characteristics is vital for proper assessment because the medical approach will be quite different.
Right. So if you're ever faced with someone experiencing a seizure, whether it's someone you know like Dan or a complete stranger, what are the immediate priorities? Our sources outline a clear assessment-based approach starting from the scene size up. This is your first look around. You want to quickly look for evidence of trauma, poisoning, or medical conditions that might have triggered it. If the patient is actively seizing, the absolute priority is safety. Move objects away from him to prevent further injury. Pat their head if you can. It's also really important to be aware that seizure activity may precede a cardiac arrest, which just underscores how serious this can be. After ensuring the scene is safe, the primary assessment is where you prioritize life threats. You must immediately assess the airway. Make sure to clear the airway of secretions, blood, and vomit to ensure the patient can breathe. That's critical. Then assess breathing and oxygenation, followed by assess circulation. Finally, based on all that, you assess transport priority, basically deciding how quickly and urgently this patient needs to get to the hospital.
And that decision to transport is indeed crucial, and there are specific guidelines in your materials for that. Several transport priority circumstances warrant immediate transport. For instance, if the patient remains unresponsive long after the seizure stops, or if their airway, breathing, or circulation is poor. A really critical life-threatening emergency is status epilepticus. That's defined as generalized motor seizures lasting more than 30 minutes or seizures that occur consecutively without a period of responsiveness between them. This demands urgent intervention, absolutely.
Okay, and other transport priorities include a history of pregnancy, diabetes, or injury that might complicate things or be the actual cause. If the seizure occurred in water, like a swimming pool or a lake, That obviously introduces additional huge concerns like drowning. Evidence of head trauma leading to the seizure is another big red flag, as is the absence of a history of epilepsy or seizure disorder, meaning this could be a new undiagnosed condition. And finally, if the seizure is the result of drug or alcohol withdrawal, that also elevates the transport priority because the underlying cause needs immediate medical management in a hospital setting.
Right. The secondary assessment then allows for a more detailed look. You'll assess the head for signs of trauma, especially important if they fell or hit something during the seizure. Note that there may be weakness or paralysis on one side of the body afterwards, which can give clues about the area of the brain affected. Also, assess the extremities for signs of trauma. Crucially, you'll assess vital signs, apply oxygen if the SpO2, the oxygen level, is 94% or below, and assess the blood glucose level. As we said, blood sugar issues are common causes. You'll also consider the need for ALS, advanced life support, meaning calling in paramedics or a higher level of care. And remember to obtain a history, including medications for the hospital staff, things like carbamazepine, which Dan was taking, give vital clues about maybe compliance issues or potential drug interactions.
So what are the key signs and symptoms to look for during or right after a seizure? As we mentioned with Dan, an aura can be a warning sign. Then the obvious loss of consciousness, and then convulsions or muscle jerking. Other important signs, though maybe less obvious, include biting the tongue, often on the sides, excessive saliva, which can be an airway hazard, urinary or bowel incontinence, that involuntary loss of control, hyperventilation and tachycardia, rapid breathing and heart rate, and that characteristic postictal confusion as the patient slowly comes back around.
And when it comes to emergency medical care for a seizing patient, the focus is really squarely on safety and support. First and foremost, you absolutely must protect the patient from injury by moving objects away, maybe patting their head. Once the seizure activity lessens or stops, position the patient in a lateral recumbent position, basically on their side. This is especially important for postictal patients to help keep the airway open and prevent them from aspirating secretions or vomit. You'll need to actively maintain the patient's airway, maybe inserting a nasopharyngeal airway if appropriate and you're trained, and use suction as needed to clear anything out. If breathing is inadequate, begin positive pressure ventilation and always maintain adequate oxygenation. The ultimate goal is to arrange for prompt transport to a hospital. And yeah, it's essential to be prepared to manage additional seizures because they can definitely happen again quickly.
Now, this is where many people, even experienced first responders sometimes, can face a real challenge. Telling the difference between a true seizure and something like syncope, or just a simple faint. The sources offer some really crucial distinctions here, don't they? Syncope, as we mentioned, is a sudden temporary loss of consciousness that occurs from interruption of cerebral perfusion, meaning a temporary lack of blood flow to the brain, not that electrical storm we talked about.
Exactly. And while it's often less dramatic than a full seizure, syncope can be a sign of serious illness or injury, particularly in older patients, so you should never just dismiss it without a proper evaluation. A common, relatively benign cause is that increased parasympathetic influence, often triggered by suddenly standing from a sitting or lying position, leading to a quick drop in blood pressure, orthostatic hypotension, basically. However, it's very easy for bystanders and even sometimes responders to mistake syncope for a seizure just because of the sudden collapse and loss of consciousness.
That's why the material provides that fantastic comparison in Table 19 LSOAR, helping us distinguish between the two. Let's break down these crucial differences. Consider the onset position. Syncope usually begins in a standing or upright position because it's often related to gravity and blood flow getting back up to the brain, whereas a seizure might begin in any position. Sitting, lying, standing doesn't matter as much. Then there are warning signs. Someone experiencing syncope might complain of being lightheaded, dizzy, or weak prior to the episode, maybe seeing spots, feeling nauseous, giving them a moment's notice. A seizure, however, might have an aura or begin without warning at all. Just boom, they're out. The return to consciousness is another really significant differentiator. With syncope, there's a sudden loss of consciousness that immediately returns when supine or prone, meaning once they're lying flat and blood flow to the brain normalizes, they typically wake up pretty quickly. A seizure, on the other hand, involves a sudden loss of consciousness that persists and then has a gradual return to consciousness, often accompanied by that postictal confusion and grogginess we discussed. It takes time. What about muscle activity? Syncope may have some muscle twitching, maybe a little bit, but it's usually minor and brief. A seizure, however, will typically involve more pronounced convulsive muscle activity or repetitive movements during unconsciousness, much more dramatic movement usually. Finally, the skin presentation is often different. During syncope, the skin is usually cool, moist, and pale because of that reduced blood flow. While with a seizure, the skin can be warm and sweaty due to the body's intense physical activity.
It's also worth noting what the sources call conclusive syncope, where there might indeed be twitching movements or even a very brief generalized convulsion, and the patient may appear confused afterwards. So even with these more intense presentations that might look a bit like a seizure, it's still distinct in its underlying cause, that brief interruption of blood flow, and usually it's much shorter duration compared to a typical seizure. For syncope, emergency care involves conducting those primary and secondary assessments, keeping the patient supine, lying flat to help cerebral blood flow, and critically, considering serious underlying causes. This is especially true for older patients, where fainting can signal more severe cardiac issues, maybe an arrhythmia, or if there are other concerning symptoms like chest pain. Therefore, encouraging transport for further evaluation at a hospital is almost always the right call.
Okay, before we wrap up, our sources include a special section, consideration for pediatric patients. Seizures in children, well, they can have unique causes and definitely require careful attention. It's certainly a high-stress situation for any parent or caregiver seeing that.
That's absolutely right. Possible causes for seizures in pediatric patients include a range of conditions, some similar to adults, yeah, but others more specific to their age and developmental stage. This list includes epilepsy, head injury, meningitis, oxygen deficiency, drug overdose, metabolic and electrolyte abnormalities, brain tumors, and low blood sugar. Significantly, febrile seizures are a very common type caused by fever in this age group, usually between 6 months and 5 years old. While often benign and not indicative of epilepsy down the road, they can be incredibly alarming for parents and require proper assessment to rule out more serious causes of the fever, like meningitis.
And when it comes to assessment in children, it involves checking their level of consciousness using AVPU. That's alert, response to voice, response to pain, or is unresponsive. It also means applying those differences between seizures and syncope we just discussed, though it can be trickier in very young children. And obtaining a thorough history from parents or guardians is absolutely vital. That history is key for understanding the context, any preceding events like illness or fever, and getting an accurate picture of the child's baseline health and development. So what does this all mean for you listening? We've journeyed through this intricate world of sudden alterations in consciousness. We've seen that while seizures and syncope might look similar from the outside, their origins, those electrical impulses in the brain versus a temporary interruption of blood flow, dictate vastly different diagnostic and care pathways.
Exactly. The ability to differentiate these conditions, to recognize the specific signs of a tonic-clonic seizures phases, or understand the critical warnings of status epilepticus, or even just spot the more benign yet still concerning signs of syncope, is truly invaluable. Remembering Dan from our case study and his likely missed carbamazepine doses really highlights how patient history and things like medication compliance are so crucial in the real world. Every piece of information helps paint a clearer picture.
This deep dive, I hope, reveals that being well-informed about these events isn't just about knowing definitions from a textbook. It's about recognizing patterns, understanding the implications for immediate action, whether you're a first responder, a healthcare professional, or simply a bystander wanting to help. It's about being prepared to respond effectively when it truly matters.
Yeah, and this raises an important question, I think. Given how subtle some of these differences can be sometimes and how quickly situations can escalate, how might a deeper, perhaps technologically aided understanding of brain activity, you know, beyond just the symptoms we can observe, evolve future emergency care protocols for both seizures and syncope? Could we someday have like real-time diagnostic tools in the field to help differentiate these more definitively?
That's definitely something to ponder as you reflect on today's deep dive. We really hope this exploration has given you a clear, maybe more confident perspective on these important medical events.